Although he is a native of Iowa, he was educated in Texas and is a graduate of the Texas Law School, University Law School. Following graduation, he served with Judge Brown of the Fifth Circuit, with Justice Hugo Black. He joined the faculty of the California State Law School, and then he came back to Washington where he practiced law. It was in February of this year that he was named by President Lyndon Johnson as the new maritime administrator. Now, Mr. Johnson, in many of his talks about the country, has readily admitted that he came into this very responsible post with only a very passing knowledge of the maritime industry, but that he was willing to apply himself and he wanted to know everything that he could possibly learn. And I think that all of us in the maritime industry will fully agree that Mr. Johnson has certainly applied himself. He has given some of us in the industry a pretty rough time. We don't agree with everything that he proposes, but he certainly has demonstrated a remarkable amount of initiative and ability to grasp the situation. There's one thing in particular I like about Mr. Johnson's talks. He always has a message. It's a pointed message. And he has a facility of pointing it and illustrating it with humorous stories. But don't let these humorous stories fool you one bit. There's something behind each one of them. It is now a great pleasure for me at this time to present the United States Maritime Administrator, the Honorable Nicholas Johnson.
All the subsidized operators rising and fully understand the desire of the rest of you to... fully understand the desire of the rest of you to complete your meal, which I think you should do. Now, I was delighted to hear that Jay Clark took his first command at the age of 23. Makes me feel like a very, very old man at 29. But I'm a little distressed to hear this referred to as the last luncheon. I don't know quite what Mr. Hilly had in mind. I note the Port of Chicago has its sign up facing the wall. I don't know if there's any symbolism in that. I know Admiral McNeil and his friends just came back from Chicago. From what I understood, it was a very successful trip. This is a terrific crowd. I appreciate it very much, although I see table four up there now. I was informed earlier that there was no table four in this room, and when asked why not, the explanation was that the room was too small to have a table four.
I don't believe everything you hear.
But you've all gone to a great length to get out this crowd. I know the first announcement was that I was going to distribute subsidy here this noon. And then the Long Beach speech came out, and that sort of fell flat. Then you actually so arranged it today that there's nothing for anybody in the shipping business to do today in New York anyway. So you have to come to this lunch. Well, I think that's going pretty far. Although actually, this is a way of getting some economy on the docks, a four-day week. It is a little tough on the executives having to handle cargo, and I can understand your appetites and you're being a little tired here today. Now, I've had an opportunity to talk with many of you in your offices here and in my office in Washington, but I think that the Propeller Club is a particularly appropriate place for us to get together because in my mind it is symbolic of something that's very important about our industry, and that is our common interest. All too often, I think, we're brought together in times of apparent emergency. I am reminded somewhat of the couple who had grown apart over the years. The husband was very much wrapped up in the stock market and spent almost all his time on this, and the wife had come to serve rather inferior meals and spent most of her time at bridge. And one day after a particularly staggering loss, this was back before our last 45 months of unparalleled economic growth in a rising stock market, he had a particularly bad day on the market and came home and said, "Are you going out tonight of all nights after this horrible day that I've had? Where are you going?" And she said, "Well, this is my bridge night." He said, "Mine too. Let's jump off together." Now, I remember Bob Bartlett talked to my home port club in Washington on Propeller Day and gave us a message that I think we ought to reread from time to time. He said, "The American merchant marine has been too often weakened by splintering and subdividing our overall interests into foreign and domestic operators, or liner and tramp operators, or maritime labor and management." Now, in the short run, our interests sometimes seem to clash, and sometimes, to some extent, they do. But in the end, I think our interests are the same as citizens, as ship owners and operators, and those connected with the maritime business. Because what we're all striving for is the strength and the efficiency, the productivity and the profitability of waterborne commerce. Almost 30 years ago, a great president of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, sent to Congress a piece of legislation which was to become the Merchant Marine Act of 1936, and he put to Congress this question. He said, "I present to the Congress the question of whether or not the United States should have an adequate merchant marine." He answered that question in the affirmative. Now, today in our times, another great president, Lyndon B. Johnson, has made his position equally clear. At the keel laying of the SS Louise Leix, he said, "To meet the challenge of foreign competition, we need efficient vessels of advanced design with low operating costs. Today we carry less than 10% of our trade in American bottoms. That percentage must be increased. A strong merchant marine is a guarantee of national security and a guarantee of economic stability." All of my efforts since coming to this office 6 or 7 months ago have been directed to that end, and I am sure your efforts have been as well. So the Propeller Club brings us together in a spirit of common enterprise, and I think it's an appropriate time to review together what it is we have been doing, some of the advances we have made. Now, some of the advanced publicity said that I was going to come here to defend the government's position, almost in the nature of a great debate. Now, let me say there is no government position. Our positions are the same. I have come here today not to talk of our differences, but of our common interests. Not of our failures, but of our achievements. A short while ago, I gave a report to the Maritime Administration staff on what we had achieved and on the need for not only a more adequate and economic merchant marine, but for a more adequate and economic maritime administration. Now, one slightly disgruntled employee I overheard leaving with the suggestion that what we really needed was a more adequate and economic maritime administrator. But aside from him, I think all agree that we have made substantial progress. One area in which we've lagged, I think, is in telling our story. I threw out in one of the first speeches the suggestion that we ought to work together on a public relations program to tell the American people, those who do not come to Propeller Club meetings as well as those who do, what it is the Merchant Marine contributes to the American economy, Now, we've not yet had many takers, but maybe we're about to have some more. And in any event, today I want to make my own modest contribution in that direction. In part, I think there's been a failure to appreciate that waterborne transportation is really a part of our national economy, our national policy. It's not simply a matter of providing subsidy to an industry that can't take care of itself. It's not like the little girl who wrote the president the other day, "Dear Mr. President, I am 11. Next week I will be 12. How can I get federal aid?" It is the support that we pay is compensation for the maintenance of a fleet in being and the national benefits which result from it. Now, I think the importance of the fleet in time of national emergency is something with which you are all familiar. And those of you who want to read this speech, as I just have here, can get a copy from Jack Tenet in Washington, and I go into this in some detail. But I would simply point out to you here that in addition to the need for carrying cargo, there is also the matter of the effect on freight rates. And I think you're all quite aware of what happened during the Korean War, during the Suez Crisis. One instance during Suez, in the course of 2 months, a freight rate on oil from Persian Gulf to the United Kingdom went from $17 to $31. The existence and the willingness to use our active fleet, our reserve fleet, has a substantial impact on prices at such a time. Finally, this industry plays a substantial role in contributing to our economy as well as taking from it, as you well know. We generate about $1.5 billion of our ever-growing gross national product. And the industry pays about $75 million in state and federal taxes. Now, Alex Purdon has prepared some information for me, which is really quite revealing. And that is that not only does the industry pay taxes, but then with the money left over, they pay their men, and those men pay taxes. And then with the money they have left over, they pay their grocer and their landlord. And the way he has it figured out, we get $1.20 back on every dollar in subsidy. And with the tax cut coming, I think we're just going to have to increase subsidy in order to keep the Treasury going. It's a very persuasive case he's put together. It's known as the multiplying effect, I think. Well, the effect of ports is very dramatic as well. I've just discovered that there's some 578 miles of waterfront here, which is something I hadn't known before, worth some $750 million. The Port of Baltimore estimates that every ton of cargo handled adds some $16 to the local economy there. And in the Port of Houston, as you know, they have some $2.5 billion worth of industry that's built up along the ship channel. It wouldn't be there but for the existence of that port 50 miles inland. So we have a lot to be proud of. And yet when I first came to the Maritime Administration, I received many of the usual counsels of doom. The problems of the industry are insoluble, I was told. I was reminded of the one time I went into a toy store just before Christmas and that last-minute panic buying we do for our children. And I was shown a toy that was incredibly complex with wires and nuts and bolts and things going every which way. And I asked the salesman what this was. And he said, "Well, sir, it's a psychological toy. It's designed to fit the child for life in our modern world. No matter how you put it together, it's wrong." Well, I accepted neither his toy nor his philosophy then, and I do not now. Labor and management working together has made great strides, I think. We've received varying estimates, some of them as high as 60 to 75% of the life of the ship and the cost of moving cargo having been incurred in port. And of course, the introduction of new technologies suggests some initial conflict between management and labor. But inevitably, the productivity of the port inures to the benefit of everyone. the shipper, the shipping company, the labor union. And I think we know that. And I think we have even more progress coming. Ship design, new cargo handling equipment. As you know, Matson recently announced a $7.2 million rate reduction in its service from Los Angeles, San Francisco to Hawaii. In announcing this, Stan Pyle said that the reduction was, quote, directly related to the improvements which have resulted from the investment of over $30 million in the company's container system and freight fleet. For this, they received a commendation from the legislature of Hawaii, and I might add from the maritime administrator as well, as will anyone who can demonstrate that he can cut costs and increase profits. Now, we also have an analogous development on the Great Lakes in the use of these barges that carry railroad cars, where I understand the cost of handling cargo has decreased from what used to be about $10 a ton to 10 cents a ton, a 99% reduction in that one service. A similar ship operating in the sugar trade in West Palm Beach can unload and load the ship in 2 hours. As you know, an operation usually takes days. Unfortunately, even though they can unload and load the ship in 2 hours, it takes 4 hours to process the paperwork. But we're working on that one too. Now, as you know, we've been working at the Maritime Administration on the Uniform Bill of Lading. As a result of this, we will be able to eliminate some 300 different bill of lading forms. Moreover, the 53 major documents still needed as a part of cargo shipments, now many of them need to be prepared as individual items, can be run off on a mimeograph machine with one master, assuring not only tremendous labor savings, but also increased accuracy. The next step, of course, is a Unicode system for devising, describing various kinds of cargo and putting the whole system on computer. Now, this is just a small example of the sort of things we're doing now. I know Likes Brothers has presented to us a very elaborate cost control system that they have. We have a value engineering program in the ship construction office. This is a part of the new economy drive in Washington that has resulted in Secretary McNamara's exceeding his predicted $1 billion savings while increasing our defense readiness. As you know, he was able to save $2.5 billion last year. We're doing the same sort of thing. And we're now able, through our value engineering program, to report savings of $1.5 million this year in ship construction. In the preservation cycle on the reserve fleet, we've got a new way of preserving the ships that is going to enable us to save the taxpayers some $2.5 million over the next 5 years. So we're all making progress in this direction. One company I heard about after I came up here has a rather remarkable record, I think, between 1957 and 1964. A 25% increase in gross operating revenue, 33% increase in net worth, a 30% increase in book value per share. Must be a period of great growth and the addition of more employees. No. Number of employees down 10%. I just note about this company that they have a very low carriage of military and aid cargo. And I note also that they have a profit-sharing incentive system, so that as soon as the profits exceed $1 a share, all the employees are cut in. And now, roughly 15% of their income is derived under this profit-sharing incentive system. And then, of course, there's Roy Gaino, who's running the United Seamen Service without any government aid at all, you see, which is a terrific achievement. And as you know, we support that with some enthusiasm. We also have management training programs. Many of you have such programs in your companies. We've recently installed not only management training programs for all levels of management in maritime, but also a college recruitment program. It's already gone into effect and bringing young people into the maritime administration. Ship construction. You know about the Mormac Argo that has permitted a crew reduction 25%. Joe Curran commented on the crew's quarters in a recent edition of The Pilot, reminiscing back 30 years ago when they were all sleeping on straw mattresses and reflecting how far we've come so far as accommodations for the crew is concerned. The cost savings from standardization ships are substantial. And you've already demonstrated much of this. It doesn't take a government standardization program. Likes has built some 26 ships of the Likes in Gulf and South American of the same or very similar design. It's affected great economies and United States Lines and other companies as well. There are now some 39 subsidized ships under construction. And as Frank Nemec pointed out yesterday, the United States now has five times the number of 20-knot ships and the rest of the world all put together. Components likewise improving. The Maritime Administration Research and Development Program has produced a propeller that's capable of driving the ship 20% faster with less power than before. The new C4 troop ships that are being rebuilt are going to show us a good deal, I think, about ship operation. The United States has the only nuclear-powered ship in the world, as you know, nuclear-powered merchant ship, the Savannah. Joe Farr is sitting over there now, proud of the ship as I am, is doing a great job in bringing distinction to our country abroad. The crowds this thing receives is tremendous. I just came back from Scandinavia, as you may know. The kings of each of the countries were there, from Norway and Denmark and Sweden, and all the major cabinet officials, and thousands of people. Little town of Helsingborg, a town of about 75,000 people, I think had 25 or 50,000 people there in the course of a couple half-day visiting period. And we now have understudy new kinds of prototypes for future nuclear-powered ships. Of course, as you have increased automation and you make the jobs on board ship more difficult, you have nuclear power plants, you need more training. Yesterday I went by to visit, on the day of its opening, the new maritime training school here in New York. And there were already four students there, eager and ready to learn. And I found a couple of them who were talking with some facility about the binomial theorem already, so I left. But we've come a long way, I'll tell you, and Admiral McClintock, who is the only man who brought his own flag, is doing a great job out at King's Point, and they're going to have a lot to look forward to in the future future training of merchant marine officers. Now, we're also doing a lot in the area of cargo promotion that we haven't talked about very much. I kid a little bit about the port of Chicago, but the Castle Group was just there. They're very well received. By and large, our experience has been very good, government and companies. Every time we've talked with American shippers, explained to them our problems, and tried to find out from them their complaints. What is it they don't like about the service we're providing? Inevitably, there have been very dramatic changes in the amount of cargo shipped on American flag ships. Castle's now been in some 13 cities, as you may know. I might point out that liner carryings of exports rose from 29.6% in 1962 to 32% in 1963. Finally, our inland waterways are becoming increasingly important to us, I think. The lakes, Great Lakes, the rivers. As you may know, we recently announced a major hearing to be held by the Maritime Administration starting at the close of the Great Lakes season this year to investigate the matter of service to that area and what can be done to promote the economy of the area and the fuller utilization of the great facility that the St. Lawrence Seaway is. Admiral Hirschfield yesterday from Lake Carriers Association mentioned that 7 years ago there were 107 hand-fired ships on the Great Lakes, and that today there are only 31 that remain. They used to have six firemen apiece on them. I might point out as well that the Mather, sailing on the lakes today, as a result, again, of a combined maritime industry research project, is now sailing with no firemen on it at all. Well, I think this short review is enough to give some indication of where we've come and where we're going, the degree of progress we've already made along the road to a more adequate, more economic merchant marine. As a part of this, of course, as I indicated earlier, we're only sharing in an economic growth of our country generally. Secretary Hodges said just the other day, our growth in recent years has been truly astounding. We are in the 43rd month of economic expansion, the longest and largest in peacetime history. Gross national product during this expansion has grown 23.4% to a record $618 billion. Employment has increased by more than 4 million jobs. Personal income is up nearly $86 billion. And corporate profits after taxes have gained $12.2 billion. This trend shows no signs of leveling off as far as the economist's eye can see. And the continued expansion, the role of the maritime industry, will be an ever-growing one. All of the energy and the efforts of the Maritime Administration are directed to this end. And yet I read in a New York newspaper only recently, we haven't canceled our subscription yet, that the Maritime Administrator is one whose, quote, criticism of high operating subsidies has aroused fears and resentments in the industry. Well, let me close, gentlemen, by laying at rest those fears, if fears there really be. Only the complacent are ever content with the status quo. You are not complacent. We are operating under a detailed legislative charter, which will soon be 30 years old. If the experience of those 30 years has not shown us the path of improvement, surely our eyes have been closed. And if the path is discernible, but we hesitate to follow it, surely we are remiss to ourselves and to our country. That our goals are similar, I illustrate with this quotation from Paul Atkinson's talk yesterday. Our country has become the greatest and most prosperous nation on earth under a free competitive enterprise system. No substitute has been found under any political system for American initiative, ingenuity, and hard work. If, and now he's quoting President Kennedy, the late President Kennedy, the excessive, cumbersome, and time-consuming regulatory supervision that shackles and distorts managerial initiative, unquote, were eliminated, I am confident that the industry and the country would be far ahead. Now, Paul assures me that was not lifted out of the Long Beach speech, and it wasn't, but it could have been. That's the same message. It's the same message. Now, I usually take some text as my theme in my speeches, trying to get some connection with the clergy, although I pick on a different source. This is from President Johnson's My Political Philosophy, which first appeared in the Texas Quarterly, 1958. He said, I do not believe we have arrived at an answer until we have found the national answer. The answer all reasonable men can agree upon. And our work is not done until that answer is found, even if the process requires years of our lives. So I picked from that the title of this address, The National Answer. Let no one mistake our goal. It is a more adequate and economic merchant marine. When the barnacles are scraped from a ship's hull, it is not to sink it. It is to help it move ever faster through the seas. Thank you.
delegates to this conference, I want to express my appreciation to Mr. Nicholas Johnson for a very fine talk. In effect, he has given us a challenge to go forward with the administration and a reappraisal of our national maritime policies to make the American Merchant Marine an ever greater instrument of foreign policy, and with it, of course, the related services within the United States. I think this is most appropriate that we mention that this is right in keeping with the theme of this conference, which is a new look at American shipping.